Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 29th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be the host today. Well, we've come to a moment which is a classic example of a punctum saliens, a turning point where if we continue in the present trajectory, dominated by forces associated with the British monarchy and their puppet Barack Obama, we will experience the most profound tragedy of human history, a full breakdown of civilization which leads to war, including likely thermonuclear war, and the danger of the end of human civilization. There is an alternative path, which depends on an abrupt break from this tragic trajectory towards a reaffirmation of the nature of man as a creative being, driven by the need to discover fundamental principles which allow for scientific and technological progress to provide an improving standard of living for a growing world population. To put it as a friend of mine would say in a nutshell, the question is whether or not we find the courage and resolve to break with the British imperial system, for which President Obama is presently the leading public figure, and join with the BRICS nations and their bold vision of a future, which is ironically based on what is properly known as the American system. On today's program, we will have two guests. First, a regular on the program, Jeffrey Steinberg, the EIR's Director of Counterintelligence and a leading figure at the center of the battle I just described. Later in the second half hour, we'll be joined by my co-host, Marcia Mary Baker, who's been scrambling to get out our new EIR special report on the Eurasian land bridge, which is now available for purchase through the Executive Intelligence Review and your organizers from the LaRouche organization. So we'll begin with Jeffrey Steinberg. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. Great to be back.
I'd like you to give your up-to-the-minute assessment of where we stand at this moment of decision for the human race.
All right, well, that's a pretty big order. Let me start with two recent developments, one rather public and one probably unknown to virtually the overwhelming majority of our audience today. The public event was the firing last week of Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. And the significance of that firing in the context of the November 4th federal midterm elections, which were a vote of no confidence against President Obama and everything that he has stood for over the last 6.5 years of his presidency. Now, in the aftermath of that electoral defeat, which was widely expected, nobody was particularly surprised. The key element of that election was that the vast majority of people who voted for President Obama in 2008 and came out again in slightly smaller numbers 4 years later to reelect him in 2012, overwhelmingly stayed home. It was a gesture of quiet but deadly protest over the fact that the Obama presidency has been a complete failure and from beginning to end has been basically one big lie. In other words, Obama made promises, he pledged to a policy orientation, and wound up going in the opposite direction in almost every instance. So in the aftermath of that election defeat, there was a groundswell of demand coming primarily and overwhelmingly from Democrats, leading circles within the Democratic Party establishment for a thorough house cleaning at the Obama White House, beginning with the most well-known and most important advisors, Valerie Jarrett, number one, Susan Rice, number two, Dennis McDonough, the White House Chief of Staff, number three. And so this pressure for Obama to recognize his failed presidency and seize upon one last moment of opportunity to bring in a team of really seasoned and professional political leaders and decision makers to run the final 2 years of his presidency and try to actually get something useful accomplished. So,
Jeff, on the firing of Hagel, does that come from the Susan Rice crowd, the Valerie Jarrett crowd?
Precisely. That's exactly the point. Obama was confronted with a clear choice. Go with people like Hagel, like General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, like Secretary of State Kerry, who have combined among them a certain experience and policy orientation very decidedly different from that at the White House of Susan Rice, Valerie Jarrett, and the others. Obama made a clear choice to stick with the White House apigenes and make none of the changes that were vitally necessary. This is a clear signal that Obama is committed to sticking with the policies of the British Empire, and those policies, if they continue for another 2 years, will either lead to a strategic confrontation, possibly a war of thermonuclear extermination with Russia, or will alternatively result in the complete shattering of the United States as the Republican nation state that we started out as. So one way or the other, the Obama presidency, as it's presently constituted, is one of those punctum salient issues that you just identified. Either Obama is removed from office now that he's made clear that he is a continuing slavish asset of this British Empire policy, or the United States is finished. Secondly, the other critical event that is probably not on anyone's radar screen. Russian President Putin just completed 2 days of intensive discussions with his top military advisors, the chief of staff of the Russian armed forces, Defense Minister Shoigu, and other top officials. They were down in Sochi at Putin's residence there, and they spent 2 days doing a thorough review of the Russian strategic situation and plans for Russia's strategic defense going forward into the future. And what they've made clear, what Foreign Minister Lavrov has made clear in a number of public statements recently, what President Putin made clear in a widely disseminated ETARTAS interview a week ago, is that the Russians believe that the policy coming out of the Obama administration, meaning the policy of the British Empire, is regime change in Russia. That the actions in Ukraine since November of last year have actually constituted a step towards an ultimate objective, which is the regime change in Russia, the elimination of the Putin government and the installation of something that would be yet another puppet regime of the system of British Empire. Now, that becomes especially important in light of the fact that Russia is one of the anchors of an entirely new set of strategic and economic relations centered around the Asia-Pacific region, but also including countries of South America and Africa who are part of the BRICS group. We've talked about this on this show on numerous occasions since July of this year, when the BRICS heads of state, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, met in Brazil and announced the launching of a new development bank. Now the Chinese have launched a Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, a Shanghai Cooperation Organization Investment Bank, and other initiatives aimed at actually transforming Eurasia, Africa, other parts of the world into corridors of true economic development and cooperation among these leading nations.
Jeff, just because so often our listeners don't quite get the connection between what the BRICS are doing and the war danger, I'd like you to just take a moment to develop that, because you know we're asking people to go out and organize as though their life depends on it, because it does. And the problem you get in the U.S. is a propagandistic press, which is the press of the empire, which doesn't tell you anything, that says Putin's responsible for the crisis in Ukraine. And I think it's extremely important that people really take the time to study this. And I'll be having Marcia on the second half hour to talk about the BRICS. And, of course, we have the new report coming out. But just give people an understanding of why it is that Obama, as a part of the British Empire, is so committed to this policy, even though it's taking us to war.
Well, I think you've got to go back and really sort of take in the fact that the United States, for the last 14 years, has been living under a kind of British tyranny. And as the result of that, of course, first we had the Bush-Cheney administration, and then Obama was elected president on the basis of a widespread mandate to reverse all of the worst of the policies of Bush and Cheney. And of course, none of that has happened. So we've had this 14-year period where, rather than moving forward into a full-blown realization of the opportunities presented by the end of the Cold War and the end of this sort of bipolar global system based on mutually assured destruction and the perennial threat of thermonuclear extinction, in this 14-year period, we have gone back towards a policy of aggressive regime change targeting Russia and China. The turn towards hostility towards the Russians, towards President Putin, began intensively at the initiative of Vice President Dick Cheney during the last presidency. And things have gone from bad to worse under Obama. And I think it's important to bear in mind that back at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, there was a clear understanding that was reached between the United States and other NATO countries and Russia that in exchange for Russia accepting without any kind of protest or compensation, the reunification of Germany as a NATO country, there were firm reassurances given that NATO would not expand eastward. That promise, that was a kind of cornerstone of the prospect for a new relationship spreading across all of Eurasia, was broken. And as the result of the fact that NATO has been continuously creeping eastward into former Warsaw Pact countries, in the Baltics, in Eastern Europe, the Russians have drawn the obvious conclusions that there is a policy of strategic encirclement targeting Russia. The Russians have made clear that they see the regime change policy in Ukraine is a model that's directed against them under these so-called color revolutions as well.
And that eastward expansion started before the Ukraine situation.
Started years and years before. In fact, it was in the late period of even the Clinton presidency that the first Eastern European countries, Poland, were brought into NATO in clear violation of this agreement. So then you've got the whole decision to establish a European missile defense system, excluding Russia from full integration into that. And again, the Russians have amply documented the fact that ultimately this system could be part of a built-up strategic first strike doctrine against Russia. So all of these developments, long preceding the Ukraine actions of the last 12 months, have been building up, and Ukraine was a tipping point because in the case of Ukraine, you had a legitimately elected government of Yanukovych that was overthrown, and some of the key forces that were used are the descendants of the wartime Western Ukrainian Nazis who literally collaborated with Hitler on the Eastern Front against the Soviet Union. So this runs very deep. The provocations are unmistakable, and they've created the situation right now where, remember, Russia lost 20 million people during the Second World War. Russia went through the battles of Stalingrad and Leningrad, and they are willing to make enormous sacrifices to defend their national sovereignty. And so basically we're in a situation right now where the aggressive provocations coming from the British directly as well. I mean, the most glaring anti-Russia, anti-Putin propaganda is coming from outlets of the empire like the London Economist. On the sidelines of the G20 Heads of State Summit a few weeks back in Brisbane, Australia, David Cameron led a series of personal confrontations with Putin that were nasty, provocative, and delivered a very clear message. German Chancellor Merkel has lined up with the British in this anti-Russia posture.
Even Poroshenko now is saying that Ukraine is on the verge of World War III. And I think the other thing that's worth noting in context of what you said earlier is that Ukraine is facing a complete meltdown of its economy. There's been a 48% devaluation of the currency this year. The inflation rate is running away. And they're cutting off pensions, just as we said they would under this IMF EU policy.
Exactly right. And, you know, the bigger problem in Ukraine, regardless of relations with Russia, is that the place is run top to bottom by a corrupt oligarchy, a private corrupt oligarchy, of which Poroshenko is probably the least corrupt of the group. But many of the so-called provincial governors who are appointed by the president are nothing but local mafia bosses, and many of these neo-Nazis from Svoboda Party, from the right sector, get their financing and get their power from the fact that they are the hooligan employees of these oligarchs. But it's the movement of NATO, it's the actions of the United States, it's all of these elements that have been playing out, particularly over this last 14-year period, that have basically poisoned all of the existing channels that had been building up in the early years of the post-Cold War period. And of course, as Marcia will discuss in the second half of the show, we've been promoting this idea of an integrated Eurasian economic space, a land bridge policy, since the early 1990s. And now that Russia and China and other countries, India, are pursuing that policy, this is considered to be a threat. This is considered to be an enemy action when, in fact, it's the best thing that could happen for mankind. So the war danger is being driven by the fact that there are now clearly defined viable alternatives for mankind to the system of British Empire transatlantic finance that has now reached a point of absolute bankruptcy. So when you have a bankrupt system desperate to hold on, the issue of war as an instrument of trying to hold on to that power in desperation becomes more and more prominent. So there's a willful element, and then there's an element of miscalculation, because this war will not be a limited war. This war, in all likelihood, will be a war among strategic forces, including overkill arsenals of thermonuclear weapons.
Well, we have only about, I think, 10 minutes left. So I want to bring up 2 points that come from what you've been talking about. The first one goes back to the Hagel firing and the split between the approach of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military under General Dempsey and the Obama-British utopian policy. I'd like you to just say a few things about that, because that gets right at this question of the willingness to risk provocations which could lead to nuclear war by Obama.
Well, one of the biggest complaints that Secretary Hagel conveyed in late October in a two-page confidential memo to Susan Rice was that the White House is running an amateur hour and trying to micromanage wars in Iraq and Syria, and now we find we're going to be escalating, if not the size of our military operations, but the lethality of our military operations in Afghanistan once again. And so the first issue that was put on the table is that you can't run an effective war against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria if there is no coherent top-down diplomatic political strategy for dealing with the Syrian government. And, you know, we had an effort that was a joint effort of the United States and Russia through the Geneva I and Geneva II conferences to get a diplomatic settlement to end that civil war that's been raging for like almost 4 years. And because of pressure from the British, from the Saudis, the United States rejected the idea of Iran, which is a critical factor in all those situations, from participating in that conference. Right now, the policy from the Obama White House remains one of regime change against Assad at the same time that we have American warplanes flying over Syrian territory, carrying out bombing missions against the Islamic State. So the absolute incoherence and incompetence and lack of a strategic policy and active diplomacy has confronted the U.S. military with a near impossible situation. Whereas under the right diplomatic framework, defeating the Islamic State is not only something that can be achieved, but it can actually lead to a stable situation at long last in that region. We refuse to recognize the fact that there is an Anglo-Saudi factor that is behind the growth of organizations like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And we continue to remain allied with countries that have been leading the creation of this terror menace. So rather than aligning with countries that have a common interest in actually crushing this network, we're in bed with them and then wonder why the policies aren't working.
Is there a channel, Jeff, for, besides now that Hagel's gone, is there a channel for the Joint Chiefs to communicate with Congress or with other people who would oppose this Susan Rice, Valerie Jarrett mafia?
The channel is weakened. There's a limit on what General Dempsey himself can do because he is the top military advisor to the president. He does not make policy decisions. He makes military recommendations. So the significance of the Hagel firing is dramatic. It weakens those other people in the administration, none of whom are perfect, but who at least represented a kind of coherent war avoidance block, such as Secretary of State Kerry, such as, you know, to a more limited extent, Vice President Biden. That whole force has been greatly weakened. You've now gone through three secretaries of defense: Robert Gates, Leon Panetta, and now Chuck Hagel. And in all three instances, they worked closely with General Dempsey and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they developed coherent strategies and were a voice in the administration against the amateur hour and British duplicity of key people at the White House. So it's a very dangerous situation. And Mr. LaRouche, earlier this week, issued a call for these leading Democratic Party veterans of multiple administrations to break their silence and come out a lot more forcefully on the basis that so long as this president, this team remains in office, the danger of war is virtually imminent and so grave as to demand extraordinary action. Mr. LaRouche has been on record calling for Obama's removal from office. through impeachment or forced resignation or invoking of the 25th Amendment, going back to the early years of this presidency. Now we've reached a breakpoint where, as you say, it's a punctum salient, a turning point moment, where we no longer have the luxury of closing our eyes, sticking our head in the sand, and pretending that somehow or other we're going to survive two more years of an Obama presidency. It just ain't going to happen. Because of positive developments that are going on in other parts of the world, that the United States, by all rights and by its history, should be aligned with and playing a leading role in. Because we've got a British-controlled White House, the war danger is immense because the British are threatened with losing everything if the BRICS dynamic takes over the world.
Well, this really brings up the question of what the listeners do, because if you think there's someone out there that's going to intervene to make things well, they are intervening to stop war, but we need to get Obama out, and that's got to come from an outcry in the population. I want to just ask one other question before we close this half hour. I know you just finished some extensive travels. Is there anything you can say about that?
Well, I think that the Marcia will take up in the next half hour the extraordinary work that has just been completed by the EIR staff here in the U.S. and Europe, preparing this really monumental study, a blueprint for mankind's survival and advancement over the next 50 to 100 years. I was traveling in Asia and had an opportunity to discuss that report, to present some of the findings and some of the preliminary sections of that report. And the reaction is extraordinary. People see that there is a crying need to go beyond even the very important and positive initiatives coming out of the BRICS, out of China, Russia, India. And what we present is a blueprint for a world land bridge and a series of scientific revolutions to carry mankind forward for the duration of the 21st century. And so the excitement that I encountered on these issues was both encouraging and it really emphasizes the awesome responsibilities on our shoulders. Mr. LaRouche has been leading the fight for this kind of new world economic order for more than 50 years. And we're at a breaking point moment from a positive standpoint as well. And that's the message that I bring back from these discussions in Asia.
And that really does get to this point that you have a Congress which is not going to take action, and it really does depend on our networks doing something.
Absolutely.
Well, we will be talking in the second half hour about the special report. It is available now. You can get it through the Executive Intelligence Review website or from the people you talk to in the LaRouche organization. So, Jeff, thanks very much for filling out this picture for us. It's clear that, you know, this is we would not be a moment too soon to see Obama ousted immediately.
Exactly right, Harley. Always a pleasure.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we just have heard now from Jeff Steinberg, and it's quite a dramatic picture, both in terms of the danger, but also the hints that Jeff gave us about the alternative. And we're really lucky to be joined by someone who, up to the last couple of minutes, has been involved in making sure that this new special report is available. I'm talking about my esteemed co-host, Marcia Mary Baker, who wears about 10 hats in the organization, but among them, she's been riding herd to make sure this report gets out. So, Marcia, why don't we just start by me asking you, is the report done?
I'm happy to say about 3 hours ago, the first 25 printed on a rush basis the other day before Thanksgiving came off the presses, and I have them here locked up on my desk because the release date of this new report is December 1st, and in Washington, D.C. on December 2nd, there will be a downtown city hotel event addressed by Mrs. Helga Zepp-LaRouche, who was and part of the originating team that there should be such a report. And she will give a briefing on the world situation. But everyone should know we have a blockbuster kind of manual for the world. The title of the report is called The New Silk Road Becomes the World Land Bridge. And it's 370 pages. And in the old days, I was thinking about this. In the old days when you got a car, maybe it's an English term, but you got a manual because you'd still make car repairs for 30 years. You wouldn't just buy a new one. It was called a works manual.
Well, now they just show you the computer symbols for what's wrong with your car.
Anyway, the works manual, this is like a works manual for the world on what is underway to build the world and rebuild and build for the future properly. And so it's kind of everything you need to know, but on an emergency basis, but illustrated with maps and with descriptions of what's happening. So I gave you the title, but everyone should know on this LaRouche Pub EIR News Service weekly report that there it is. It's finished. Those of you who ordered it will be getting it soon, within the next 10 days, couple weeks.
Now, Marcia, you say there is a hard copy you just got, but there's also a PDF version, is there not?
Yes. You can order either an electronic version, that's $200, or the hard copy with shipping is $250, along with handling, and it is out. And I'd like to talk about, in this time we have, some of the contents of it, but I'd like to say right up front, Harley, that a very important mass circulation item is under preparation for intervention by the LaRouche Political Action Committee. Maybe you mentioned it already, but it's going to be a 16-page newsprint-style pamphlet, and I mean in mass numbers. We can get this everywhere. And the title is something like, Why the United States Must Join the BRICS, A New International Order for Mankind. And that's in the works and will be ready probably in the next 10 days or so.
And let me just add on that is going to be coinciding with a whole series of events. Sort of the kickoff event is the one on December 2nd in Washington, D.C. But there are going to be local events all over the country. And this mass pamphlet is going to be coming out to give people at least an initial introduction into the subject matter. And our listeners should contact your local LaRouche office to find out where the meeting will be in your area and start organizing for it, along with the petition that we have on the website for the U.S. joining the BRICS. So right. We have these various capabilities now that are available. And I think the most important, though, is this report, because, as you say, it's a manual, but it's an in-depth historic scientific discussion of everything you need to know to rebuild the world. So why don't you give us a little sense of what's in this report?
Well, the front end of the report, maybe 25% of the report at least, is titled The Metrics of Progress. Because how are you going to measure what ought to be done in the world? Don't we all know that our neighbor, our cousin, or our enemy always says, well, you can only do what you can fund, only what you have money for. You can't go into debt, all that crap. So the front end of the report has four sections, and they address the fact that one way to measure progress is by, are you contributing to the basis for yet more progress in the future as a never-ending process. So think of this in terms of energy. Are you contributing to higher levels and higher density forms of energy, which has higher use values, so you can do more things faster with less effort? This report goes into it historically, the way we once were stuck with just burning twigs. At least we had fire. Hmm. But then we burned yet more higher yielding fire in the form of burning charcoal that was treated wood, and then in burning coal, and then burning coke that was treated coal, And then I could go on and on, oil, but you get up into nuclear fusion in terms of, well, first you have nuclear fission. We should have that in a plentiful way, which we don't, but we must commit to that. And then you go on from there, and the question of the most efficient kind of nuclear fusion, that is making use of helium-3, which is we can get from the moon. So it the first part of the report is not geographical per se, Harley. It mm-hmm. covers such things as energy. It covers what I just said, the principle of what I just said about how you measure progress in terms of water, for example. We shouldn't just say, well, we have water now because we have wells. But what if the wells go dry? Well, duh, does that take a lot of conceptualization to figure we ought to be doing something for the future? So it goes into what we... how we can think about what we can do, how we can conceptualize the planetary system, the Earth in terms of the solar system and solar cycles, and how it recommits our thinking and our effort to think how if there's a lot of vapor in the atmosphere, which there is at any given time, evaporated from the oceans, could we make that rain where we want to? I'm presenting this in a very simple way.
No, but I think the important thing, I really liked that as the lead to the report, because what Lyndon LaRouche has always emphasized is that what we're organizing for is a principle, that some of the specifics in terms of the programs will change, and you know, for example, as we've changed our perception of NOAAPA, but it's the principle, and this principle of productivity, what is productive human labor, has been lost in the Greenspan and post-Greenspan era.
And just to finish that off, when I'm talking about the report covering metrics of progress, it does cover money and credit from that point of view. That what is the idea of credit? Well, it's the idea of organizing to have an intervention so that there will be a future for mankind, the principle of organizing for the future. So you don't think of how we're going to fund what we're talking about doing, in terms of, well, there's only so much money, and therefore you can only that's how you're going to decide. Do you have enough money? Do you have what does the budget allow you to do, and what won't it allow you to do? That's crazy thinking. So there's an historical section of the report of the development of what was known in the 1800s as the American system in the United States, building on the conceptualization of Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, these great early figures who had that commitment to understanding money and credit as the means of creating the physical and cultural and cognitive future for mankind. So there's a couple of dozen pages on that. And so once we've established our thinking of how we're going to measure what ought to be done in the world, then the rest of the report is mostly a geographic roundup of what's underway, what ought to be underway, and in this from continent to continent. And the way that's organized is simple. The first areas under consideration are the key leaders in Eurasia of the BRICS nations, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So the first geographical section is on China, then on Russia, then on India, but then on all the neighboring geographical areas, it covers all of Eurasia, including Southeast Asia, Southwest Asia, which the British used to call the Middle East, includes Africa, of course Europe, but Australia, and the Western Hemisphere. So that is a very big part of this report. You can look in the index and look up where you want to read about. And finally, the report concludes with a short section on what you could consider as models of development. One of them is geographical, the story of the Tennessee Valley Authority that under Franklin Roosevelt and his administration, the entire Tennessee River Basin, with all its tributaries, it's a multi-state area, was conceived of as a unitary challenge, and dams, navigation, flood control, electricity, and what became Oak Ridge, the Center for Nuclear Fission Development. All of this was part of the TVA project. Otherwise, it has South Korean miracle, the Deng Xiaoping story. So you can look at figures or examples of development, and the special feature there is a repeat of the history of the fight for development by Mr. LaRouche and his wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, with illustration. So that's the whole report in outline I've described to you. It ends with just a two-page epilogue, which really is where we are right now. It ends with a resolution that was passed at an international conference in Germany just a few weeks ago, or 6 weeks ago maybe, that ask individuals, no matter their rank, their station, whether they're elected or not, to sign a resolution to commit to this kind of development. And that's what we're doing right now, Harley. You just described it. We have a number of meeting occasions. People can set their own up, too, if they're in a certain kind of more remote area.
Sure, we can always do a Skype hookup or something like that.
Yeah.
I have a couple of questions, Marcia, that I'd like you to just present. When you talk about the geographic roundup, some of these projects actually are already underway, are they not?
Well, let's get into one. Just last week, Central Eurasia, that is in western China. Now, you're talking about in Xinjiang province, the westernmost province of China, which is about the same size as Alaska, but it's landlocked. A high-speed rail, not just ordinary rail, opened up that's about 2,000 kilometers, and it goes across desolate area, wilderness area mostly, from a town in more populous China called Longzhou, and it goes out way out into this Xinjiang province of the Uyghur territory in a town called Urumqi. So here's one of the second longest high-speed rail lines in the world, and it's open for commercial traffic. It has a schedule. You can look it up and see when you want to go, and it's part of the idea of there will be new cities and towns created in this area, not just we're in the most favorable spots, let's just put it that way. And this line is what would it be like here in North America? I think it would almost be like starting in Minneapolis or maybe Chicago, going up through the prairie provinces to Moose Jaw, and then swinging over to Whitehorse, and eventually ending up in Anchorage, except because the idea being you would start repopulating this area, because it's been depopulated quite a bit, and you're doing it. Why are you doing it? It's deliberate development. That's what's the exciting thing. You're doing it for deliberate reasons to serve development purposes for mankind in this part of Eurasia. Now, where I described to you is going from east-west or west-east, and it is part of the old romantic Silk Road. I always think of the famous legendary names like Tashkent or Samarkand or Xi'an, these famous places, oases, and with beautiful architecture, and caravans of camels and horses going along here. But now, this nearly 2,000-kilometer line is like the traffic hub. Xinjiang is like the traffic hub of the entire new Silk Road World Land Bridge that goes all the way from China across Central Asia, and all the way to, you can end up in Germany. And this is not an exaggeration. So this is a whole different approach. And it's, this, as I said, they had this opened commercially last week. It had its test run this summer in July, I think. And now it's underway. So just, that's one example. There are a few other outstanding examples in the world. Maybe the most outstanding is that the Suez Canal is being there's being a second lane, in effect, being added to the Suez Canal, so you don't have to have all these choke points and take a long time to go through the canal because you have to go on a siding canal lock and wait. You won't have to do that anymore. They have 81 companies working on a 24-hour basis to excavate on a rush basis, and they are... This is underway. This is underway. So it puts us in a whole new realm of thinking, does it not, about what is a jobs program? So you don't get some twerp on television telling you whether he's Republican, Democrat, Independent, Tea Party, Coffee Party, whatever, saying XYZ is a jobs program, and you know he's a big liar. Here are jobs programs.
And on that, one of the things that's very exciting about the, particularly the Chinese approach, is that they have, and I think the Russians also, have adopted the concept that Mr. LaRouche put forward initially, that these are not simply connecting rail lines, but they represent corridors of development. And I noticed in the recent reporting we've done on Egypt that they're taking that same concept to... greening the desert between the Nile and the Suez Canal. That again, it's not just a transportation link or a connecting point, but it actually represents something that will upgrade the area in between. That's the real jobs program.
Yes, yeah, so it isn't as in the ancient times going from oasis to oasis across the Sahara, the Western Sahara, or in the great deserts of Eurasia or the Taklamakan Desert. No, you're talking about the buzzword, and it's a good one, is connectivity. You are developing, you are planning out grids, interconnections, where you can transport goods and people and upgrade the basis of productive activity for the future. And the so looking at some of the sections of this new report, it's quite exciting. For example, Central Asia, which is often full of, it includes the Aral Sea Basin, part of the Caspian Sea, and includes some of the highest mountains in the world. You don't always hear about them, but they are. So it's a very challenging area for, it needs more water, but it has high mountainous terrain. But there are plans for how to use the mountain passes, how to crisscross the desert, and eventually this is an area, part of the priorities for the world, of how to bring new water resources so that you can have development. So it's when we have this terrible anguish of years and years of the British Empire great game, for example, in Central Asia, of what's been done in Afghanistan, what's being done now in Southwest Asia, in Iraq. And you counterpose to that the rebuilding that we can do, the resource base, and then how we can create the resource base. It's quite a gripping picture, and And the efforts to do this are underway. The signature theme of this whole report is, of course, is the BRICS as an institution, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and collaborating countries like Argentina, like Egypt, and others. But right now, Harley, as we see in the transatlantic going down the drain hole, as we see the European Union and the United States economies, along with Canada, collapsing, there is a reaching out in and around the BRICS. To be concrete, here's an example. For example, the Eurasian Economic Union that has in it Belarus, Russia, and Kazakhstan. That's in Central Asia. Kazakhstan is a near neighbor of Afghanistan. It's a neighbor of the entire region. It's part of the entire region there. The Eurasian Economic Union is right now, in this week, issuing a memorandum of understanding with our own South American neighbors called Mercosur. That's the southern part of South America that has in it Paraguay, Uruguay, I think Argentina and others. And they are, this memo of understanding that they're doing commits them to mutually beneficial trade, scientific collaboration, and other kinds of collaboration. So you see, this is a new impetus, a new thrust for our entire planet. And that brings us back as to how, to use a railroad expression, we better get on board, little children here. And
well,
that's
me,
what
let me
we're
ask
to...
you, in terms of the U.S. side, besides the need to support, to break with the IMF, to break with the City of London, and break with the phony valuations that are dominating finance, there's also the question of what can be done in the U.S., and is there a section on U.S. infrastructure projects that would connect with this?
Yes, let me say there is a section on South America that reviews it, and North America, the United States and Canada and Mexico. And one of the things that's outstanding about that is, look, we were just talking about high-speed rail across desolate Western China. Well, we never built a rail connection simply between the state of Alaska through Canada and the lower 48. That's an emblem of all the work we have to do in general. That we need to do that. It was mapped out in 1942, I believe, by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in a rush job in case it was necessary for defense. And there it sits. Their original survey is in the archives in Seattle of the Army Corps of Engineers. Sure. And you'd be going through Alaska, British Columbia, or through the Yukon Territories, British Columbia, and then swing into Canada and swing into the U.S. So we have maps in the new report of what we ought to be doing there. And needless to say, if you look at the planet, once you have that on this in the Western Hemisphere, if you build the tunnel under the Bering Strait in Alaska and go into eastern Siberia to the state of Chukotka there, then you can connect to Asia by the World Land Bridge. And that's presented in the report. And that's under discussion in Russia and has been proposed vigorously. Russia, too, has to finish its link from Chukotka West to connect with its rail grid. It doesn't yet exist, but they built it quite a distance to the Amur River anyway in Siberia at Yakutsk. And we have a artist's rendering there of how we should, what it looks like at that rail terminus. So this is what we ought to be doing. And in the United States, the other undone symbol is the fact that we're going negative. We are losing nuclear fission power from where we once had 104 operating plants. We might only have 100 now in operation at a time when we need nuclear power for the industrial drive we need in the world, for rail, for all kinds of infrastructure. And we need it for nuclear power desalination. I don't have to tell you, you're in Texas. In West Texas, it's far worse. But in California and our western states, west of the Mississippi, we have a world-class crisis of water. So the report goes into nuclear energy and the other necessities of what we need to commit to in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And that's the fight. So there's a rundown given, as I say, with maps and with summaries. And I'd like to point out, because many people listening to this weekly program follow EIR online in print, and the November 28th issue has a cover story by Paul Gallagher on what we need to do in North America.
Good. Now, Marcia, in the first part, the discussion of the metrics of progress, you answered the question that comes from boneheaded Americans who say, well, how can we afford it? Because that gets at the whole credit policy and how an economy really works. The other issue is the so-called environmentalists who are opposed to progress for basically hostility to science and the human race. I don't suppose this is addressed explicitly in the report, but this is one of the underlying themes, I think, of Lyndon LaRouche's work going back to the time you and I joined with him 4 decades ago. So is there some discussion there about the idiocy of the carbon and then greenhouse gases, or do we just say, look, this is all nonsense, let's go with the future?
Well, I'll give you the lowdown. We did have a chapter on that in the end, and we didn't do it. We were you're not going to find it in there, in that we were going to debunk and have documentation of how the whole green environmentalist movement is part of the genocide movement of the world in the last 60 years, eugenics and everything. Then we just didn't have the time or room, but it is addressed from the highest level in this sense, that if you think the metrics, if you want to decide what we ought to be doing in the way of projects, not because they're merely pretty or we like them or rivers are nice and we should have a river walk or something. If you think that we need to contribute to the future by deliberately developing an upgraded productive base, higher and higher skilled people, then it all comes from your mind. In other words, the real developer of the resource base and the physical universe, geologically and in water reserves and in every way, is the mind of man. And that's discussed in this report in the very first chapters on the metrics of progress in energy and in water and other forms, that it's the mind of man that creates so-called natural resources, in quotes. Natural resources are man-made. So that's very explicitly in there in many ways, Harley, and without the documentation of who the bad guys were that would deliberately create a so-called green movement in order to prevent development. So from that sense, it's very powerful.
And we've reported on that quite a bit, and I think the thing that you're saying that's most important is this emphasis on how the American system uniquely represents this idea that it's human beings, the human mind, that is the ultimate resource. And this is now no longer a secret of our Constitution, but it's being unleashed internationally. And this is where the United States has to go. So, Marcia, we're almost out of time. How do we get this report? How do people get it? And what does it cost?
Well, again, look on LaRouchePub.com, and you can go to the store, and you can the store there, and you can follow the prompts and do it that way. You can get in touch with anyone through the contact available on LaRouchePub.com or through your friends that you know in EIR News Service, but in the LaRouche effort generally. And if you get an e-copy, it'll be $200 a hard copy, and it is in full color throughout with all the maps and everything else. Is $250, and we're going into successive mass printings. We will have it on hand December 2nd in Washington, D.C. at the special event that will be addressed by Helga Zepp LaRouche. So that gives you an idea. And also be on standby to do general mass organizing with this LaRouche Political Action Committee 16-page pamphlet.
And that'll be coming out through LPAC, and we do need LPAC contributions, LaRouche Political Action Committee contributions, to make sure that that is not a limited circulation. Marcia, we're out of time. Thank you so much for taking time after this exhaustive effort to put together this report, and thanks for the work you did on that. And we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.